This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Julian Ng, and welcome to the show that's all about personal finance. And today, of course, being the last Thursday of the month, we have Ring It Ring In, where you can call in or send us your questions. The number to call is 03-77-109-000. You can also WhatsApp us on 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. And Rajan Devadasan, SE licensed financial planner with Manulife Asset Management, has kindly joined us this morning. Rajan, Happy New Year. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Hi, Julian. I'm very good, thank you. And Happy New Year. Both late greeting and early greeting.
So, for both the New Year's. So it's the start of the year and we're still in that resolution-making mode. Any thoughts for 2017?
I think 2017 is going to be a very exciting year. For me personally, last year was very, very tough. My mother passed away on August 12th last year. My father-in-law passed away on November 6th. Markets were very, very tough. I was actually very glad when December 31st rolled around and we clicked over to January 1st. So we've got a brand new year. It's still only January. I think it's going to be an interesting year. I am actually expecting 2018 to be a really exciting super growth year. And I think 2017, for people who actually structure their portfolios correctly and who maintain a decent level of liquidity at all times throughout 2017, I think they'll do very, very well. Mainly because I think there will be opportunities for markets to dip substantially. The Dow just crossed 20,000 points, and I think that's great. But, you know, the higher any market index rises to within a short span of time, the more likely it is that irrational exuberance kicks in.
It's very interesting when you talk about the Dow crossing 20,000, because the Dow has almost tripled and quadrupled from the lows of the heights of the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009.
Tripled.
Yeah. So compared to Malaysia, it rings true with your opening statement that it was a bad year. The ringgit was extremely weak. Oil prices were down. And there is just a permeating sense of a very weak sentiment here in our country as well. What does that tell us of how we should manage our investments? Because too many people in Malaysia have too much of the money at home and missing out the kind of growth opportunities that are out there.
I just want to clarify, when you say too many Malaysians have too much money at home, stuck in their mattress or invested in Malaysia?
EPF, for example, 75% are invested in Malaysia. The property is Malaysian. The salary is Malaysian. A lot of Malaysians get ESOS off their respective listed Malaysian companies. So very entirely Malaysian-centric in their investment portfolio.
Cool. I believe that it would be wise for Malaysians, actually everyone, to not put all your eggs in one basket. I know it's cliched, but it's still incredibly valuable advice. Don't put all your eggs in one basket, which means that you need to diversify. And I would continue to recommend that my clients, my listeners, my friends, my enemies, anyone, what you want to do basically is to have three dimensions of diversification taking place. I believe, number one, you got to diversify across different asset classes. Number two, you should diversify across geographic regions. So do not have all your money in Malaysia. Do not have all your money in China. Don't have all your money in the US. Have it spread out. Spread out as far across the world as you possibly can. And then the third level of diversification is to try and diversify the entry points across the timeline. Let's say you end up with a durian runtuh situation and you end up with far more money than you've ever held before. Don't feel that you really need to go and throw everything into the market at one point in time. It's very unwise.
Okay, we have Rajan Devadasan, SE licensed financial planner with Manulife Asset Management, here to answer your personal finance questions. Call us on 03-77-109-000 or WhatsApp us on 016-201-9000. You can even tweet us at BFM Radio. We have a caller. Aloysius is on the phone.
Hi, yes, that's me.
Yes, please go ahead.
Yeah, so I have a question. Actually, I am around 25 years old, and actually I want to get my own property within 5 to 7 years' time. What should I do to achieve that goal?
Thank you, Aloysius. Rajan, 25-year-old looking to buy a property.
Excellent. Very good question, Aloysius. Thank you for it. I don't know anything about your Aloysius, but I assume that if you are conventionally employed, your employer pours money into EPF, which is a great thing. If you are running your own business or you plan to run your own business anytime in the next couple of years, one of the smartest things you can do is actually to make sure that you flow a portion of your money into EPF as well. That way you end up with money growing in account one and money growing in account two. What you should do between now when you are 25 and the time that you turn 30 to 32 is to take time to look at the property market and watch for dips. Decide on why you're going to be buying. Is it because you want to live in your own place, or do you actually want to become a property investor earlier rather than later? And whatever your reason may be, I would suggest that you start a separate savings and investment program on the outside to help you raise your down payment on the house. I also would recommend that when the time comes for you to make the purchase, that you look at your enlarged EPF balance and probably empty everything that you have in account two. One, so that you can actually afford a good piece of property, and two, so that you actually minimize the loan that you're going to be taking. Now, when you go to the bank and you are negotiating the loan, at this juncture, because even at the age of 32, you're going to be relatively young, you may be inclined to say, well, let's see whether I can get a 30-year loan or a 35-year loan just to make the monthly payments affordable. What is likely to happen is that over the next few years, actually over the next many years, you're going to end up earning more and more money. So I actually don't have a problem with you taking a very long tenure mortgage as long as your lock-in period isn't terribly long. I have worked with clients who, to be able to balance their budget at the point of purchase, have taken 30-year loans. But I have sat down with them and I've said, look, I'll hold your hand. We walk together on this journey for as many years as is necessary. And I think it's entirely possible for you to pay off that loan in full within 7 to 10 years. Usually, I'm greeted with looks of shock and incredulity.
Mm-hmm. Rajan, there is this other conundrum for people who don't have enough money to buy a property, but they are set on actually buying a property at all costs. Are there any other options for these people? What's your view on that? And should it always be a default case that you must buy your property?
One of the icons of the U.S. mutual fund industry, I think he's still alive, is Peter Lynch. And Peter Lynch ran
Fidelity,
the Magellan Fund. And he, in one of his books, actually said that probably the best investment for most people is to go out and buy your own piece of property. But you asked a very good question. Does it have to be a default? Property prices in Malaysia are escalating. When you look at what we have across the region on a capital-by-capital basis, whether you're looking at Singapore or Jakarta or Bangkok or KL, KL's expensive, but it's still relatively cheap. And I think, except in the rarest of circumstances, everybody should aim to try and buy a piece of property. However, if you feel that your first purchase is going to be not as an owner-occupier, but as an investor, then what you want to do is look at the relative yield. I mean, there's not a lot of point buying a piece of property for R1 million and then finding that because of the rental environment, you're only getting 1.5 to 2% in terms of rental yield. In that case, to get the same level of investment real estate exposure, I would recommend that they look either directly at listed REITs or at a fund that holds REITs, real estate investment trusts.
We have Rajan Devadasan, who is SC licensed financial planner with Manulife Asset Management, here today to answer your personal finance question. So if you have anything to ask Rajan at all, telephone us at 03-7710-9000, WhatsApp 016-201-9000. You can also text at the same number or tweet us with your questions at BFM Radio. This is Ringgit Ringin. We'll be back with more after this. BFM 89.9. You're listening to Ringgit and Sense, and this is Ringgit Ringin, where you can call in or tweet us or write in for your financial questions. We have Rajan Devadasan joining us this morning. He's from Manulife Asset Management, a SC-licensed financial planner there. He's here to answer any financial issues that you may have. Call us at 03-7710-9000, WhatsApp us or text us at 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. And we have a caller on the line. His name is Kenny. Kenny, please ask your question.
Hi, morning. Okay, my question is relating to what Raj said earlier. I just want to find out when he said don't put all your eggs in one basket. Because, like, for myself, currently I have some properties, about two properties, and I'm invested in the unit trust as well as the mandatory saving in EPF. So apart from that, I mean, when you say what other type of investment is for me that I can do?
Thank you very much, Kenny. Rajan?
Very good question. And Kenny, by the way, congratulations on being highly successful.
You've got two properties.
Two pieces of property. You've got unit trust. You obviously have got money in EPF. Kenny, might I suggest that you also look at the private retirement scheme, the PRS, at the very least to make sure that you take advantage of the 3,000 ringgit tax relief. So that hopefully will help you immediately. No charge for this piece of advice. As far as...
or any other piece of advice that will come out of this
absolutely.
Show today.
Yeah. But Kenny, you said that you've got unit trust, which is great. But because you didn't specify what types of unit trust, can I just make an assumption that you, like many people, may have a tendency to actually use unit trust somewhat incorrectly. If I'm wrong, Kenny, I apologize in advance, but just for the benefit of all listeners across the country, unit trusts are not an asset class. Unit trusts represent a delivery mechanism potentially for as many asset classes as you like. However, because of the commission structure, many unit trust agents have a tendency to only put their clients into equity unit trusts. They pay the highest commissions, and truth be told, they also generate the best returns over the long haul. But because unit trusts are not an asset class, they're actually a delivery mechanism for different asset classes. I have structured unit trust portfolios for my clients with three asset classes, four asset classes, five asset classes. And when it comes to five, I think it gives them a breadth of exposure that protects them a great deal. Let me just very quickly tell you what those asset classes are. Those would be cash, fixed income, equities, investment real estate, and then what's known as alternative investments. In my case, it's specifically commodities. So just make sure that if you're using unit trust, that you're not just stuck in one space, that you're not just stuck in one country. Spread it across the world and go into different asset classes. I hope this helps, Kenny. And congratulations on the success you've had.
Okay, and we have another question. I guess the other thing that happened in 2016 and very much highlighted in the previous years as well is the degree of debt in Malaysian households, I think hitting almost 90% of the GDP right now. We have a question here. This person has 4,000 in credit card debt and finding it hard to clear. He's asking whether a balance transfer would help his cause, and what are some of the pointers you would give him?
That's a very good question. Did you get a name on that?
No name.
Okay, right. So Mr. Anonymous.
Arvin, actually.
Oh, Arvin. Yeah. Okay, Arvin, hi. Whenever I stand on a platform or even right now, when I'm talking about debt, I have to let my listeners know that I'm not speaking from a position of strength, but from extreme weakness. I got into personal credit card debt problems in the UK. It took me many years after coming back to Malaysia to dig myself out of the hole. In the 90s, for a short while, I ended up with credit card problems in Malaysia. So I know what it's like, and I understand the allure of balance transfers. So listen very carefully to what I'm going to say right now. 4,000 ringgit in debt in the broader context is not that bad. So will you just pat yourself on the back and say, thank God I don't owe 40,000 or 400,000 ringgit. Now, 4,000 is doable. Unfortunately, you're still going to end up paying between 600 and 800 ringgit per year in annual charges. And quite frankly, I'm sure you'd rather spend that money on yourself and on your family than to go and make very rich bankers even richer. So when it comes to credit card debt, my recommendation is that you do two things. Look at your cash flow statement and try and squeeze out an additional cash flow surplus. Some financial planners call this a margin, and allocate a portion of this excess surplus toward paying down your debt as quickly as you can. The most effective thing you can do when it comes to dealing with credit card debt is to tell yourself you're not going to charge any more until that debt disappears. Balance transfers will work, but only if you don't structure things in such a way that you end up in worse shape than you started off. And I'm talking from first-hand experience. Now, if you do a balance transfer, what you're going to try and do is to reduce the cost of borrowings. But if you take a balance transfer and the credit limit on your credit card gets completely cleared and you then end up with fresh margin or fresh credit balance to start charging again, you're going to end up in much worse shape. If that's the case, then do not do the balance transfer. However, if you can be assured that you will exercise the discipline necessary to clear the credit card balance and then you will only charge what you can pay in full each month, then by all means, go ahead and do it.
Okay, it's ringgit ringgit and the questions are still pouring in. So we have some time left, not a lot of time left for questions. Call us, tweet us, or what email us or WhatsApp us. And we have a question here, pretty interesting actually, Rajan. I think you would like this question. Considering the market these days, what is the best way to earn without lifting a finger, passive income, right? I also want to give you the other two questions so that you have an indication of the timing that's involved. There's this question about what is your EPF Sharia outlook for the Sharia account? And we have other questions coming in as well.
Okay, let me deal with the passive income option first. And let me tie it in with EPF in general, not specifically Sharia at the moment. I remember when I first started working in Malaysia, it was March 1990. I joined TV3 as a cadet broadcast journalist. I only lasted 17 days there before I quit. but then I joined Malaysian Business Magazine and I stayed there for 4 years and 1 month. And over the years, as I started my Malaysian career and I saw my EPF balance grow, it started off as being very, very small. But after working for about 3 or 4 years, I remember looking at my statement thinking, my goodness, the dividends that I'm receiving on this large amount, it's actually a sizable fraction of my total earnings. And I had a really good feel about it. So that's why EPF has been very good to me. It has helped me through the utilization of Account 2 to pay off my home, the home that I still live in with my wife. We took a 15-year loan, and because I know how to run the numbers, at that time, you were allowed to only use EPF account 2 money once in 5 years. So on the 60th month, I cleared the entire loan. So there's a lot that can actually be done. But when it comes to passive income, I want to echo the words of, I believe, one of the Rockefellers. Trouble is, I'm not sure which one. But it basically is to say that the thing that really fills my economic heart with satisfaction and joy is when my dividend checks come in. I love investing in high-quality dividend stocks and then knowing that when I receive a dividend inflow directly into my bank account, let's say from Nestle or Maybank or whatever company it may be, it excites me a great deal. So if you don't want to lift your finger, what you want to do is work extra hard, extra smart. Build your cash flow surplus, invest maybe in a dividend fund, and also if you have the skill set to go and buy high dividend yielding stocks. Now, you had a question about the EPF Sharia.
Yes. Quick one on that.
Okay, so I can understand why some people would choose to go down the Sharia path, but my understanding of EPF's ruling is that whether you're Muslim or not, once you opt for the Sharia option, it's a one-way street. You actually can't get out. So my recommendation is that if you actually want to retain maximum flexibility, just stay with the conventional EPF program. And then if you are withdrawing your money, let's say for an EPF member investment scheme program, tell your advisor that you actually want Sharia compliant stocks. That way you can have your cake and eat it.
And would the returns be about the same between Sharia and conventional?
You're talking about EPF or funds?
Expected returns between EPF, conventional accounts and Sharia account.
Well, speaking logically, if we go through an 08 type crisis, which was a credit crisis, then you would assume that the Sharia universe will do better. But under normal circumstances, obviously the Sharia subset is by definition a subset, whereas the conventional world is much larger. So I would assume over the long run, conventional will generate better returns.
Okay, Rajan, we have only about 2 minutes left in our show, and there are two of the same questions. How much should a person spend a percentage of their income on housing loan servicing? And we'll take this call that's coming in from Samantha as well. Samantha, go ahead and ask your question.
Hi. Good morning. I just have a quick one. At the beginning of the show, you mentioned that it would be good to mention to maintain a decent liquidity for everyone to, you know, welcome the challenges. But at the same time, I would assume that because you also mentioned it's a good time if we would want to purchase property for ourselves. So how to balance it, whether to, you know, keep up with cash or basically to just invest? I have a unit on our own, but I would like to invest as well. So I am in a dilemma of this.
Okay, I think the question, the last question was about how to split your cash between cash, property, and other assets.
Okay. Hi, Samantha. Thank you so much for your question. I think before you do anything, before you overextend in terms of buying a house, before you go into high-risk investments, I think it's very important that you build your EBF, your Emergency Buffer Fund. So over the long haul, if you are conventionally employed, you go to work and you get paid on a monthly basis, I would recommend that you have between 3 and 6 months' expenses in a cash buffer fund, kept either in bank savings, bank fixed deposits, or pure money market funds. If you are Bumiputra and qualify for ASB, by all means, keep all or a portion in your ASB. As far as deciding how to balance between having a cash surplus and buying a house, don't have too much. Some people get addicted to cash. And what happens is if you've got too much cash, it sterilizes your long-term returns.
It's a good problem to have.
It is. But, you know, when you realize that Asia has the highest savings rate of all continents and we love our cash, over the long haul, it's going to cause a retirement crisis because we're not going to grow our money fast enough. So it isn't just real estate. You also need money in equities. You need money in commodities. You want to have a broad-based approach.
Okay, one more minute. The other question on percentage of income that should go to servicing housing loans.
I would say 20 to 40%. And the reason I've gone as high as 40% is because houses are getting really expensive. But if you can actually start off at the 30 to 40% range, then what you want to do is to work hard and work smart to increase your income so that percentage over time comes down.
Rajan, thank you so much for joining us. And you've just heard from Rajan Devadasan, who is SC Licensed Financial Planner with Manulife Asset Management. And you've just heard Ringgit Ringin. There are many more questions coming. I'm sorry that we couldn't answer your question because we are running out of time. But do check in with us next month, same time, same day. This has been Ringgit and Sense on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.